So I have this, as I mentioned before, I have this emerging research interest in Muslim-non-Muslim relations. And this began with an interest in what is conventionally termed Western Muslim relations. And since I'm uncomfortable with these symmetrical descriptions, either equally willing dialogue partners or clashing civilizations, I tried to capture it in asymmetrical terms. So I try to understand global Islamism, so the political, the transnational political Islam, as you will, and cosmopolitan world society as rival globalization projects, where one is trying to transcend borders, get rid of borders by de-emphasizing them. That would be the cosmopolitan project, and the global Islamist project would be an attempt to scale up a particular communitarian vision, group vision, to the global level. Well, these were huge generalizations. It's coming out now as an article, and I'm moving to slightly more medium level and also more empirical research interests. And I'd like to investigate these emerging powers in Asia, so specifically Chinese Muslim, Indian Muslim, and Russian Muslim relations, the quality of these relationships and how they are managed, and then to find out what light that throws on how we in the West are dealing with the issues. So this is just broad, and I'm well aware that it's quite daunting, but I want to have a go at this. And I will now introduce Thomas Pierret. He's a lecturer of contemporary Islam at the University of Edinburgh. He got his PhD from Paris Sciences Po and Catholic University Louvain in Belgium. And that was focusing on Syrian Sunni ulama, and he's going to talk on Syria today. He had a focus on religious authorities in this context, obviously, but also then Islamic activism related to that and the management of religion by state policies. He has articles on sectarianism, particularly Sunni Shiite, religious legitimization of authoritarian regimes, post-Islamism as a concept, and currently he's studying Islamic forces in the Syrian Revolution. There are various publications, including a 2013 book with CUP. And with that, I hand over to you.
Thank you, Jan. I'd start with an anecdote. It was last November in Al-Bab, which is a city close to Aleppo in the north of Syria. And an armed group called the Tawheed, the Unity Brigade, established an institution called the Hayat al-Amr bil-Ma'ruf wa Nahy al-Munkar, which means the Committee for the Promotion of Virtue and the Prevention of Vice. And as many of you know, this is the same name as the well-known religious police in Saudi Arabia. A few weeks later, the now former president of the Syrian National Coalition, Sheikh Mohammed al-Khatib, who is himself a kind of man of religion, mentioned in a speech and condemned the fact that some of these rebels in the regions they control were, for instance, trying to prohibit people from smoking, and even, according to him, had executed a woman on the basis that she was guilty of fornication. And, of course, all these facts certainly confirm or reinforce Western prejudice about the implementation of Sharia as being a kind of heavy-handed imposition of an Islamic lifestyle. And the purpose of this presentation is to show that things are a lot more complicated. First of all, I'd like to stress the fact that this issue of vice and virtue, public morality, in fact, is quite a marginal factor behind the establishment of these Islamic jurisdictions in liberated areas. There are much more important issues at stake, state building or state rebuilding, more exactly, and the restoration of law and order, primarily. also the establishment of Islamic jurisdictions in these regions has led to many tensions and conflicts. But I want to emphasize the fact that the conflict is not between secular law and Sharia. There is a very broad agreement upon the principle of Sharia in these regions, and the conflicts are rather between competing projects of institution building, of judicial institution building, backed by different military groups, or between courts set up by military groups and others that try to establish themselves as independent jurisdictions. Just a word about the context. The concept of Sharia is not entirely new in the Syrian legal system. In the Article number 3 of the Constitution of 1973 and 2012, so the one that was issued after the start of the revolution, Islamic fiqh is said to be one major source of legislation. It's kind of a vague formulation. In practice, however, it's a largely secularized legal system. The only clearly Sharia-based part of the code is personal status, and the rest of the legal code was completely secularized in 1949. In addition to that, the ulama have been excluded from the judiciary, including from family courts, even before the advent of the Ba'athist regime for various reasons. But there's been, over the last decades, the combination of the global Islamic revival from the 1970s on, broadly speaking, combined with the well-deserved discredit of the Ba'athist regime. And this combination has led to a large number of people, I mean, as in other parts of the Muslim world, looking at the secular legal system as illegitimate. Including among the judicial personnel, there has always been, I mean, even under the Ba'ath in Syria, a kind of strong conservative religious lobby among the judges. There was I think it was in 2009, one of these judges called Sheikh Al-Kardawi during his program on Al Jazeera and asking, you know, I'm a judge in Syria and I'm implementing positive law. Is that, you know... permissible or not, and the judge, of course, was fired a few days after that.
What did Qaradawi say?
Sorry?
What did Qaradawi say?
I think he said that he should not implement, secular law if they contradict Sharia or something like that. Just remember the anecdote this morning, to be honest. I had to go back to my documents to provide you with a more accurate answer. Another thing is that given the distrust towards the state in general, you know, not especially towards secularism, towards the state, there has been a persistence and maybe a revival, but it's not possible for me to assert that, of informal arbitration by men of religion. And it was very common, for instance, for merchants or businessmen to settle their dispute by asking for the arbitration of a sheikh. So in that context, it's not difficult to understand why, when Assad's forces withdrew from large parts of the northern and eastern province of Syria, so I'm speaking mostly of Idlib in the northwest, Aleppo, Raqqa, and Deir ez-Zor in the east. So when Assad's forces withdrew from most of these provinces, so they still control the main urban centers there, but not the provinces themselves, in 2012, there was a wide consensus among the population upon rebuilding a judicial system on an Islamic basis, vaguely defined. All the more so that these are certainly the most conservative parts of the country, and these are regions that are very, very predominantly Sunni Muslim. There are very few religious minorities in these regions, so very little opposition to it. How about the establishment of that new judicial system? The first judicial institutions were established in order to address two main needs. First, local communities were in need for protection from insecurity that result from the collapse of the state. You have gangs that exploit the situation, the security vacuum. and also exactions by rebel groups, looting, arbitrary detention. Increasingly now, they are selling goods to Turkey in exchange for money and weapons, like machinery from factories they dismantle, wheat reserve, which is kind of a problem in a country where nobody is eating, you know, sufficiently. Oil, which is seen, and rightly so, as a kind of public resource. And so all these problems, you know, people were in need for judicial institutions to address that. And armed groups themselves were in need for arbitration between themselves. For instance, how do we share the booty? The booty when they seize, for instance, a military base. How do they share the weapons they find them between the different battalions who were involved? And in order to avoid in fighting, usually they would ask for the arbitration of some recognized authority, usually a man of religion or something like that. Also, how to deal with prisoners. Of course, there are many extrajudicial executions, but some prisoners are not executed, and also having some kind of court may be useful to know what to do with them. Later on, these courts, let's call them like that, also fulfilled other functions. There is a very interesting case in Aleppo, in a very poor neighborhood. It's another committee. It's called the Committee for the Promotion of Good. But the second part of the name is very interesting. It's not the prohibition of vice, it's or the prevention of vice. It's the support for the oppressed. Nusrat al-Mazlum. And it's both a kind of court and an organization that try to address the needs of the many needy people in the rebel-held part of Aleppo, which is mostly destroyed. And of course, I'm not denying the fact that there is also a moral agenda of, you know, vice and virtue police. But I think so far it's relatively limited and localized, because there is some self-limitation on the part of the armed groups, and also some social resistance. Although many people in these regions have no problem with the principle of Sharia, forcing Syrians to stop smoking, for instance, is absolutely, I mean, probably impossible. They are among the biggest smokers in the world. I think number two after China. In terms of organization, of course, these were at the onset very localized initiatives in the different villages. But there has been a process of vertical integration, at least as far as I know, in Idlib and Aleppo, so north and northwest. So you have some kind of unified hierarchy at the provincial level. There is an agreement upon a code, which is called the Arab Union Code. I had never heard of that before, but as far as I know, is a Sharia-based code that was agreed upon by the Arab ministers of justice in 1996. I have no idea if some countries are implementing that. Syria was not, obviously. But it's an agreement in principle, because in practice it's a system that's based much more on arbitration than on punishment. So according to a colleague of mine who did some field work in the province of Idlib, and met with a sheikh who had kept record of the decisions he had taken in his court, 85% of the decisions were based on sulh, so conciliation or arbitration, rather than on hukum, punishment. So there are very few punishments. The reason being that, they're not easy to enforce in such a context. Law enforcement is quite difficult. But also they are really concerned about preserving the unity of society, which is extremely fragile. You have armed groups everywhere. Okay, they have a common goal, which is overthrowing the regime, but you're always that close to have them, you know, fighting with each other. So these judges are very concerned about trying to preserve harmony between them. This entails that usually hudud, punishment, corporal punishments, are not implemented. And I think it's very easy for them to justify that, because there are, I think, several arguments in the Islamic legal tradition to justify not implementing hudud in such a context, because it's a context of war, and because there is no state authority. I think the idea is widely accepted that they should not be implemented now. Of course, some do. I mean, this example of a woman being executed for fornication is a counterexample, but it seems to be rather the exception. And again, in terms of organization, these courts have some form of police force, which is provided by rebel battalions, but of course, which this is a situation that severely curtails their autonomy with regard to the rebel battalion. Now, a word about the personnel, the judicial personnel. There was, and there is still, a problem. I mean, they have a shortage of trained judges, because judges were either discredited as pro-regime, or they remain in regime control areas. I mean, the largest, you know, judiciary institutions are in usually the urban centers, many of which are still under the control of the regime. And also, judges belonging to rather privileged categories of society, usually they fled the country when they could. So they have this problem of shortage. And the gap was filled to a large extent by Muslim scholars, or sheikhs, because many of them were trusted by the population. Because also, probably many people see it as natural that a man of religion run a judicial system that's based on Sharia. Well, natural. But the problem is that these clerics have little or no knowledge of legal procedures, because they've never been involved in any judicial process. And an additional problem, many of them have a limited knowledge of Islamic sciences in general, because these are usually low-ranking clerics, because the high-ranking one, like the very knowledgeable person, it's the same problem as for judges, so either discredited as pro-regime, or they stayed in regime-controlled areas, because when you're in, for instance, the western part of Aleppo, which is in the hand of the regime, even if you don't like the regime, it's better to stay there, because you don't have bombers and artillery shells falling all the time. And also many of these high-ranking scholars fled the country, went to Egypt or Turkey. So you have a problem of training, and that's why the sheikhs in the courts have received important support from lawyers. But there you have another problem, is that lawyers, they have been trained in the Syrian legal system, which is a predominantly secular legal system. So they have little knowledge of Islamic law, or at least Islamic law as being implemented in the courts. Okay. So now, probably what I've presented now gives a kind of a false image of harmony, peace and harmony. Of course, it's a contested process, this implementation of Islamic courts. I will provide you with two case studies. One is the Unified Judicial Council of Aleppo versus the Sharia Committee. So you have in Aleppo two competing judicial institutions, the Unified Judicial Council, which is the mainstream, relatively integrated structure at the level of the province, and the Sharia Committee, which is a court run by a coalition of Islamic and rather hardline Islamic groups, including the famous Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda. Both of them implement, in principle, Islamic law. And beyond that, even the Unified Judicial Council, which is supposed to be less Islamist than the Sharia Committee, I mean, there is a distinctly Islamic flavor in what it does. For instance, it reduces the sentence of prisoners who memorize part of the Quran. And they implement this Sharia-based Arab Union Code, again, in principle. The Sharia Committee is supposed to be structured, but the main difference between them is not about that. It's not about the nature of the law that is to be implemented. Is that the Unified Council is an increasingly autonomous judicial institution, and it's really trying to be autonomous, whereas the Sharia Committee is run directly by the Islamic groups I've mentioned. And they want to retain a judiciary arm. And not so much because they're really eager to implement, public morality. But it's a resource of legitimacy they use against other groups, and in particular again rogue elements among insurgents. So they've carried out several operations against, thugs turned rebels, and it's always under the umbrella of this Sharia Committee, which gives them, legitimacy to try to destroy these problematic elements. And my that really my very last word is just to come back to this committee, which actually was established in this city in order to compete with the already existing Sharia committee, which was supported by Jabhat al-Nusra. And this one was established by another Islamic group. It's a more moderate one from Aleppo. And it seems that the choice of this name had nothing to do with establishing religious police. It was very much a kind of symbolic overbidding, you know, like a slightly less Islamic group trying to pretend that it's even more religious and then even more legitimate than Jabhat al-Nusra, but they were mostly dealing with issues of law and order and problems created by, say, rogue elements in the insurgency. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you.